Okay, forerunners of the Reformation. I'm just going to get as close to 4 o'clock as I can, and then we'll go home, okay? So about 30 minutes of focus, concentration. You got a little food in your stomach, so that makes you a little happier, right? Forerunners of the Reformation. John Wycliffe. Wycliffe is first, W-Y-C-L-I-F-F-E. Although you can spell his name about a dozen different ways. I've seen it at least that many ways. So as long as you got a Y and a W and a C somewhere in there, you're probably okay. Now notice the dates, okay? So this is prior to the Reformation, but he's one of the forerunners of the Reformation. He produced the first complete translation of the Bible into English. He's called the Morning Star of the Reformation. Now, he was an Englishman and a priest, but he started to read the Bible. And as he read the Bible, he was born again, had a real conversion experience, and he began to see that there were a lot of things in the Bible that were different than the Roman Catholic Church had taught him. And so he taught, following your notes, that the Bible was the sole authority for the believer and that Christ, not the Pope, is the head of the church. He condemned many of the doctrines of the Roman church. So he declared that the Pope was not infallible and that not the head of the church, and the Pope actually might be the Antichrist. But you know, all the reformers all believe that.
Amen.
Amen, King says. So, he was an influential man, though, and he starts preaching, and people start getting saved. There's a real revival that takes place in England. And as a result of this revival, many of the men that get saved feel called to preach. But they don't want to go through the official Roman Catholic channels. And so a whole army of lay preachers begins to go throughout the nation of England preaching the gospel. Now, as happens throughout history, often names of movements and organizations come from the enemies. Like Methodist was a negative name, right? And you see that throughout history. And the English people called these followers of Wycliffe lollards. Lollards, which is close to an English word. We talk about lollygagging. To loll around means just lazy bums. People who won't work. Because they're preaching the gospel. And the Bible declares that if you preach the gospel, you ought to make your living from the gospel. So they're getting their living from the gospel, not from working. They're called lollards and not really happy. Now, the Pope condemns Wycliffe and calls for him to be arrested. However, interesting bit of history, at this time, the Pope is French. Do you know how the English feel about the French? Even to this day, you know, they were at war for about 700 years. France and England, on and off. You ever heard of the Hundred Years' War? It was actually 111 years. Fought between the French and the English. So there's not a lot of love lost, even to this day, although they sort of tolerate each other. But, you know, they don't get along that great. And at this point, of course, a French pope is commanding the English people to turn over Wycliffe. Now, most of the English and all the English clergy hate Wycliffe as much as the pope, but they hate the French more than they hate Wycliffe, and so they refuse to surrender him. So he dies a natural death. However, 44 years after his death, papacy has been returned now to Rome, and so it's not a French pope. the English Roman Catholic Church digs up Wycliffe's bones and puts him on trial. They have a trial and they bring evidence against him. And he's condemned as a heretic and sentenced to be burned at the stake 44 years after he died. Yeah, so 1384 plus 44. They burn him at the stake. Yeah. And they scatter his ashes in a nearby stream that leads to a river, that leads to another larger river, that eventually leads to the Atlantic Ocean. And years later, people would say those ashes of the Reformation went from that little tributary and spread all throughout Europe. And really, that's what happened. It was Wycliffe's example that begins to initiate and inspire people to dare to resist the Roman Catholic Church at this time. So Wycliffe is a fascinating guy. What he did is he translated the Bible into English, which was radical, you see, because all authoritarian organizations have to control the flow of information. So one of the ways to do that is to keep the Bible out of the language that the people can read. So he translates the Bible, and these Lollards, as they go, not only preaching in English, handing out Bibles in English, but teaching the people to read English. And so that's why the Roman church sees this as a threat. See, because if people start reading the Bible for themselves, they know what's going to happen. And this initiates a great, yeah, and a great sort of groundswell that's going to eventuate in the Reformation. That's why he's called the Morning Star. And that's why the Wycliffe Bible translators, that's why they get their names. That's what they do. They translate the scriptures into native languages in honor of John Wycliffe. So, a great man. The next fellow is Jan Hus. You might pronounce it Jan Hus. H-U-S-S. But it's Jan Hus. H-U-S-S. So notice the dates, close to Wycliffe, but later. Condemned the abuses of the church and was burned at the stake as a result. Now, he was from a part of Europe like Bosnia, Serbia, that kind of eastern, southern eastern Europe. And the Fox's Book of Martyr record his martyrdom. It says, when wood was piled up to his very neck, the Duke of Bavaria was so officious as to desire him to recant. But he said, no, I never preached any doctrine of an evil tendency, and what I taught with my lips, I now seal with my blood. And so he was burned at the stake, gave his life as a martyr. However, the church that he started, the Hussite Church, would continue after his death and would continue to grow and grow until in the 1700s, a fellow by the name of Count Zinzendorf would establish on his huge estate a place called Herrnhut, and the people there were the descendants of Jan Hus. We call them the Moravians, and the Moravians would begin on Zinzendorf's property a 100-year prayer meeting. 100 years. 24 hours a day for 100 years. Prayer took place by these descendants, spiritual descendants of Jan Hus, at Zinzendorf's estate for the nations. And when we get to the modern missionary movement, it was the Moravians who initiate the modern missionary movement, and they begin to pray for the nations, which is something that for over 1,000 years the church had stopped doing. It stopped sending missionaries or praying for the nations. And the Moravians start again and begin sending missionaries all over the world to all sorts of places. One of my favorite missionary, Moravian missionary stories is two young men, late teens, early 20s, who sold themselves into slavery to go to this one particular slave camp because the gospel was prohibited. No ministers were allowed to go there. And so they sold themselves to a life of hard labor and slavery because they knew that was the only way the gospel could go. And as they were on the ship being transported, knowing it's the end of their life, their parents are there and weeping, why did you do this? And their statement is to win for the Lamb the reward of his suffering. So these are the kind of missionaries that the Moravians sent out. And they trace their spiritual heritage back to Jan Hus and his stand against the Roman church and his martyrdom. Next fella, interesting character, Desiderius Erasmus, E-R-A-S-M-U-S. A little bit later now, the greatest humanist scholar of the Northern Renaissance challenged many church practices. Now, Erasmus remained a Roman Catholic all his life, but he did a lot of things that were very significant in initiating the Reformation. First of all, he translated, or the only Bible we had at this time was called the Vulgate, translated by Jerome in the 4th century, and it was based on bad manuscripts, and the Roman Church had mistranslated all kinds of words and terms to express their bad theology. For example, instead of Jesus saying, repent and believe the gospel, in the Vulgate it says, do penance and believe the gospel, which is very significantly different. Erasmus discovered all these new Greek manuscripts and created a good working Greek manuscript that could be translated now to the native languages. He also so ridiculed the Roman Church that when Luther comes on the scene, people are ready in droves to leave the church and to follow Luther. Initially, Erasmus supported Luther, but then when Luther actually breaks with the Roman church, he attacked Luther and became his bitter enemy. Joseph?
Yeah. Was he a believer? Because I noticed that you put him in before the Reformation.
What he did led to the Reformation. Will we see him in heaven?
Yeah. Well, based on his writing, because some of his writings we tackle in school, and it's not particularly Christian. It's, like you said, humanistic. So fighting for the poor or the value of the human life, but not particularly Christian.
If you put a gun to my head and said, I got to make a decision, I would say no. But again, flip the coin. We'll find out. If I get there first, I'll check for you, Joseph, okay?
Don't let me know, please.
Joseph. Johann Gutenberg. G-U-T-E-N-B-E-R-G. Opened the door for the rapid dissemination of knowledge through his printing press. He also inadvertently undermined the authority of the Roman Church, which had controlled the distribution of knowledge for many centuries. Now, when Luther comes on the scene, his writings can be published rapidly, and they do. His 95 Theses, which we're going to talk about, which really was the tipping point of the Reformation. Within 3 weeks after he tacked them on the Wittenberg church door, they had been published and spread through all of Germany. And within 3 months, copies had gone through all of Europe. Now, this would have been impossible if it wasn't for Gutenberg. And the Reformation could never have happened. So Gutenberg, Christian, I don't know, certainly devout Roman Catholic, but this invention, significant for the advancement of the Reformation. Joseph.
Would you say that that's...
I don't know if he's a Christian or not.
No.
If I get there first, I'll check for you.
Would you say that that's why Luther, the Reformation happened during Luther, even though there was Wycliffe and there was already a need for it, and, you know, situation was ripe already for the Reformation then?
Not ripe enough.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't... There was still some maturation.
Yeah, it's the fullness of time, so... All right, that's the prelude. Now, we're going to talk about one of my favorite individuals in all of church history. A man, you got to love him and hate him at the same time. Quite a fascinating character. One of the most interesting people in the history of the world. Lutheran Reformation, we'll look at the Reformation in several different phases. The Protestant Reformation was the turbulent 16th century religious and political revolution. And it's important to understand that it was not only religious, it was also political. So in 1998, I took my two boys on a mission trip. We went to Norway. Norway is a Lutheran nation. They embraced the Reformation in 1527. And officially became a Christian Lutheran nation for political reasons. It was all political. The king saw this as an opportunity to break with the influence of the Pope and to establish his authority. So to this day, you know, I think I told you it's a Lutheran nation, so there's a state church. So when you get your paycheck, the state takes out their taxes and your tithe out of your paycheck, which goes to the Lutheran Church, or if you can designate it. That goes all the way back to 1527, but it was politically motivated. So there's a lot of politics at work here. Remember, it's the rise of nationalism. We don't want this extra national organization dictating what we do as a nation. So, you see, there's a lot of different factors involved, which ended the supremacy of the Pope and established the Protestant churches. Now, Martin Luther came to believe Christians are not saved by their own efforts, but by the gift of God's grace accepted by faith. All right, so Martin Luther, actually his real name is Luder, L-U-D-E-R, is a good German man, but it transliterated into English for us, Luther. His father had been a coal miner, but had made some money, and through investments, actually became a member of the prospering middle class. And so all prospering middle class gentlemen wanted their sons to get education. And so he paid a considerable amount for his son Martin to be educated as a lawyer. But one day, as he was leaving his parents' home, and heading back to college, there's a huge thunderstorm. And he's sure he's going to die. This is about 1505, okay? And so he cries out to St. Anne for help. And he pledges to St. Anne, if she spares him, he'll become a monk. Now, why did he pray to St. Anne? Well, it's interesting. St. Anne is, according to Roman Catholic mythology, the mother of Mary. Remember, early on, the church began praying to Mary. You go to Mary first, she'll go to Jesus, he'll go to God. Now, at this point, Mary is so holy, you don't even pray directly to her. You got to pray to her mom, St. Anne. So you give your request to St. Anne, she'll pass it along to Mary. Mary will take it to Jesus. Jesus will take it to the Father. So that's why he prays to St. Anne. And she apparently hears his prayer. And he's saved. And one thing about Martin Luther, he's a man of convictions. So probably all of us in our pre-Christian days prayed prayers like that. I know I did. Lord, if you get me through this one, if you get me out of this, you know, I'll do good. I'll go to my, I'll just, I'll do something. But he's the kind of guy, he made that pledge, he follows through. So he announces to his father, all this money that you spent on my education, I'm going to be a monk. Many of you maybe experienced that when you announced to your family that you're going into the ministry. Maybe they paid for your university education, and thanks, Mom, Dad, but these aspirations you had for me, I'm going to be, not a priest, a Protestant gospel campus minister paid by asking people to give me money. Well, that's probably a little bit of what Martin Luther experienced. Now, Lollards. He decides if he's going to be a monk, he's going to be the best dang monk in the world. So he's going to be monk number one. He's going to be the most extreme, the most dedicated, the most devout. Matter of fact, his leader in the monastery he was in, one time said, Martin Luther, what you need to do, please go commit some real sins. So his spiritual leaders actually tell him, you need to commit some real sins. It would be good for your soul to actually sin. Because he was putting so much pressure on himself to be absolutely perfectly holy. So I'm reading from his writings here to give you a little taste of his extreme asceticism. It's not in your notes. It's only in mine. So you can look up at me or look at the sky or look anywhere you want, but it's only right here. He said, for however irreproachably I lived as a monk, I felt myself in the presence of God to be a sinner with a most unquiet conscience. Nor could I believe that I pleased him with all of my efforts. I did not love, indeed, I hated this just God. If not with open blasphemy, at least with huge murmuring. For I was indignant against him, saying, as if it were not really enough for God that miserable sinners should be eternally lost through original sin and oppressed with all kinds of calamities through the law and the Ten Commandments, but God must add sorrow upon sorrow and even by the gospel bring his wrath to bear. He said, thus I raged with a fierce and agitated conscience. And yet I continued to knock away at the Apostle Paul. He started reading the book of Romans. And he thinks somehow his answers are there. And he keeps banging at Paul, trying to find out what he's really saying. In this place, he says, thirsting ardently to know what he really meant. Now about this time, he thought, the best thing to do, I'm going to take a pilgrimage to Rome. Okay, that's going to be the apex of holiness. I'm going to go to Rome where the Pope, the holiest place of all, there I'll really find out what it means to be a really, truly holy follower of Christ. So in 1509, he's so excited, he goes to Rome. And he's excited about, he goes to this one place where he can say all these different masses. And he's just excited because he's building up all this credit, getting his dead relatives out of purgatory, and pretty excited about it. But he sees all these terrible things. He sees priests walking into brothels in open daylight. He sees pilgrims being propositioned by priests at the holy shrines and being led away for sexual purposes. But there's a place there called the Santa Scala. It's his church, and there's this long series of steps. Supposedly, according to the teaching of the church at that time, those were the steps that Christ had walked up when he appeared before Pilate. They had been mystically transported from Jerusalem to Rome. And pilgrims would scale these steps on their knees, saying whole rosaries on each step as they went up. You see, there's a really vivid scene. If you've seen the movie Luther, it's a pretty good movie pretty accurate. It'll help you understand. But there's a scene where he walks up and you see the knees are bloody and people are going through this terrible torment. And he gets to the top and he looks down and he has this thought. What if it's not true? What if it's all just a lie? And so these terrible thoughts now are tormenting him. He says later, I'm reading again from his writings, I was seized with the conviction that I must understand Paul's letter to the Romans. But at that moment, one phrase in chapter 1 stood in my way. I hated the idea, in it the righteousness of God is revealed. I hated the righteousness of God who punishes sinners. But at last, meditating day and night, and by the mercy of God, I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that through which the righteous live by a gift of God through faith. Here I felt as if I were entirely born again and had entered paradise through the gates that had been flung open. Now, he recorded in his writing that he got this revelation, he uses a Latin phrase, in cloaca. When you translate in cloaca, it means sitting on the toilet, taking a dump. And I personally, I've had some great revelations at the same place. So it's possible that this revelation that breaks open the Protestant Reformation happened while he was on the toilet. But more likely, in cloaca was also a phrase that the monks used to refer to being depressed, down in the dumps, so to speak. So, like, man, I'm just sitting on a toilet, smelling that, whatever words you want to fill in there. On October 31st, 1517, he published his 95 Theses, opposing the sale of indulgences to build St. Peter's in Rome. In 1521, he was summoned by Emperor Charles V to Worms, okay? Don't say worms, Worms. The German W's are always pronounced with V's, right? To recant his view. Now, what had happened, remember, Pope Leo, okay, Pope Leo wants to build St. Peter's in Rome. Now, St. Peter's is the largest, most expensive church in the history of the world. And Leo needs cash. So he hires this fundraiser, a guy by the name of Johann Tetzel, to raise money by selling indulgences. So you make a cash donation for the building and you buy time out of purgatory. And so Tetzel is the ultimate marketing genius. So he gets his whole traveling show. He's got actors, he's got props, he's got this whole, basically it's the 16th century version of special effects. And he starts going from city to city, raising money. And he's good at it because demons come out on the stage and they take relatives and they go screaming away to hell and they're tormenting them. There's flames and fire and recreating hell. And he's making people feel guilty. Your father may be experiencing that torment right now. And yet there's a possibility by your gift you can ease his torment. And this is just a brilliant marketing strategy among these poorly educated, highly superstitious people. And he's even got songs, little jingles. One of them was, when a coin in the coffer does ring, a soul from purgatory does spring. So he's got all these little fancy jingles people are singing, and they got these nice little lines, and he ends up in Luther's territory. And Luther is incensed. He publishes 95 theses. You just tax them up on the Wittenberg church door. It's not a major deal. Scholars do it all the time. If you read the 95 theses, there's nothing too radical about it at all. You think, what's all the fuss about? But it was the right thing at the right time. It's a tipping point. And so they spread, within 3 months, all of Europe is reading them. And then the Pope is not happy, and he begins to issue discussions or decrees towards Luther. But Luther starts reading more. And as the Pope begins to force him to recant more, he becomes more hardened in his convictions. And there's a papal bull that's sent that he must recant his writings within 60 days. But when the 60 days are up, he brings all his books out. Instead of burning his books, he burns the Pope's document in public. I mean, you talk about, that's like, you just don't do things like that, okay? But Luther, he's a wild man, okay? He's just out of control. And finally, Charles V, who is the most powerful human being on the planet. He's the leader of the Holy Roman Empire, France, portions of Italy. He owns most of the world. And he's a devout Roman Catholic, and he is angry about this upstart German monk. He commands him to come to Worms to recant. And so here Luther stands before the most powerful human being on the planet with all his regal court. And the first day, he's daunted. He says, give me a day to think about it. But the next day he shows up and he says this: unless I am refuted and convicted by the testimonies of the scriptures or by clear arguments, since I believe neither the Pope nor the councils alone, it being evident that they've often erred and contradicted themselves, I am conquered by the holy scriptures quoted by me, and my conscience is bound in the word of God. I cannot and will not recant anything, since it is unsafe and dangerous to do anything against the conscience. Here I stand, I can do no other. God help me. And Charles said, fine, burn him at the stake. Kill him. And so they took him to kill him. But the political ruler kidnapped him, took him to the castle of Wartburg, and kept him in hiding until the firestorm sort of died down. So he was in this castle for 10 months, so he didn't have much to do, so he translates the whole Bible into German. A Bible that is still read today. My daughter, who has her university degrees in German, she reads her Luther Bible. So she reads Luther's Bible as a part of her devotions to keep her German up. And the Bible in German just printed and spread throughout the whole nation, and revival begins to take place. But we'll leave that until we meet the next time, because it's 4 o'clock. So I want you wishing I had continued rather than wishing I had stopped. So I'm stopping. We'll pick it up later. I'll tell you some fascinating thing about Luther's primary passion. Two things that he loved the most is he loved to drink beer and cuss. And so we'll tell you some of his beer drinking and cussing stories next time. Yes, Joseph?
Guys, we have a decision. March 29 is our next, this time next week, except that's in classroom 106. So it's a little bit tighter, but we could be done with this third semester of staff div if we do it next week. Or we can go again April 12th. It'll be here.
Next week. What do you want to do?
So who votes for 29? Just finish this next week. Who wants to do it April 12th?
Looks like you've been outvoted, Joseph.
All right. Okay.
Okay.
Huh? Half day. Because we've just got one half day left. Yeah.
Which half is it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you would prefer. Because it's you, Pastor Paul. So it's only afternoon for you, huh?
No.
We can do morning?
Are you doing the morning up there?
Oh, yeah.
Good, then I'm finished. I'll do the morning. Do you guys like the morning or the afternoon?